From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Rolling Stones' Rock and Roll Circus. The film of this 1968 concert featuring the Rolling Stones, John Lennon, and The Who was never released until now. We'll hear the story from the film's director, Michael Lindsay Hogg. Also, the story of a newly restored movie classic, Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 masterpiece, Vertigo. We'll talk with James Katz and Robert Harris, who restored Vertigo, as well as Spartacus, Lawrence of Arabia, and My Fair Lady. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Claire Bloom's Leaving a Doll's House, an account of her 18-year relationship with novelist Philip Roth. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A Texas city's zoning battle is now a national fight over religion. The Supreme Court will use the case to decide whether a federal law protecting religious freedom is constitutional. The case involves a church's fight to build an addition in an historic district. The justices also decided to refuse to hear Dr. Jack Kevorkian's arguments against a Michigan court's ban on assisted suicide. The court will rule later on whether states may pass laws that ban that practice. GOP presidential nominee Bob Dole is in San Diego in preparation for tomorrow night's final presidential debate, but Dole takes time out today to catalog what he calls a pattern of ethical problems in the Clinton administration. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports from San Diego.
Yesterday in Kansas City, Bob Dole compared potential White House scandals to Watergate. He talks about an ethical administration, Dole said. He doesn't have one, and we're going to go after that in the debate Wednesday night. Today, Dole plans another attack with an afternoon rally during which aides say he will chronicle a series of administration missteps and ethical problems. Dole will demand an explanation for large disputed campaign contributions from a wealthy Indonesian family. Dole now repeatedly asks audiences whether he should get tougher on the president as he lays the groundwork for the final debate. President Clinton has had no response to this latest barrage of attacks, saying only that the public enjoyed the civil tone of the last debate and will be the final judge of what happens Wednesday night. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in San Diego.
The fire lines are holding in California's Big Sur area, where a brush fire has burned more than 21,000 acres. The fire burned about 3,000 more acres during the night, but it's still within containment lines. Those lines are now around 95% of the blaze, and full containment is expected by tonight. CSX Corporation this morning announced that it's buying Conrail for $8.4 billion. The merger will create one of the world's largest freight rail companies. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
The new company will service the eastern half of the United States. CSX officials say the merger will allow straight-through rail freight service for the first time from all major points in the Northeast and the Southeast. The companies estimate the move will save them up to $550 million annually and create a new service that's better able to compete with the trucking industry. The sale continues a trend toward consolidation in the railroad industry. The government created Conrail in 1970 after several railroads went bankrupt. It was sold in a public offering in 1987. With annual revenues of more than $14 billion, the merger of the railroad giants creates one of the world's leading freight companies. Officials say there will be some job losses after the merger is final late next year, but it's not yet clear how many. In Philadelphia, this is Eric Westervelt.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 2.5 points in heavy trading. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is up 3. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary William Perry says there is no consideration being given to an international force that would include U.S. troops to patrol the West Bank city of Hebron. Perry made the comment before a meeting today in Washington with Israel's defense minister. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat said today he's ready to have U.S. troops guard Jewish settlers in Hebron if that would calm Israeli fears. King Hussein of Jordan visited the West Bank today for the first time since losing the territory to Israel in the 1967 Middle East War. In Jericho, the king told Palestinians he would stand by their side against Israel. It was a surprise visit, signaling Hussein's acceptance of Palestinian rule in the West Bank, and it comes at a critical stage in Israeli-Palestinian negotiations on an Israeli troop pullback from Hebron. Public broadcasters and print journalists in France are on strike today to protest the government's plans to eliminate their tax privileges. Some journalists in the provinces say they'll stop covering legislators who support the bill. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
There's a virtual blackout of news coverage today on public radio and television stations. Wire agencies are also affected. And while the Paris Daily Le Monde is not on strike, many newspapers, especially in the provinces, are. The protesters are angry about the government's plans to scrap tax breaks for 100 professions, including journalism. Journalists now get a 30% tax deduction for professional expenses. The government wants to eliminate that over 5 years as part of its austerity measures. Journalists say the measure will cost them a month's salary. Prime Minister Alain Juppé said he won't give in, though he did ask the economics minister to make sure that no group is put at a disadvantage. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
General Motors announced today that it earned nearly $1.3 billion in the third quarter. That's nearly double the earnings for the same period last year, but the news isn't all good for GM. The strike against General Motors in Canada is forcing more layoffs in the U.S. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Morrow, publisher of the new cookbook, Baking with Julia. Savor the joys of baking with America's best bakers, based on the PBS series hosted by Julia Child. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
You've heard of Oxford Circus. You've heard of Piccadilly Circus. And this is the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And we've got sights and sounds and marbles to delight your eyes and ears. And you'll be able to see the very first one of those in a few moments.
That's how Mick Jagger opened the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus on December 11, 1968. The circus was a rock and roll concert held in a North London TV studio featuring the Stones, John Lennon, The Who, Marianne Faithfull, Taj Mahal, and Jethro Tull, as well as clowns and trapeze artists. Jagger loved circuses. The concert was shot on film and video with the intention of making it into a movie and TV show, but neither were made. Now, 28 years later, there's finally an edited film. Its showings this month at the New York Film Festival sold out in hours. The concert is now out on home video and CD. My guest Michael Lindsay Hogg directed the concert and the film. Back in the 60s, he also directed the British rock and roll TV series Ready, Steady, Go. He directed the Beatles' last film, Let It Be. His dramatic films include The Object of Beauty and Frankie Starlight. I asked Michael Lindsay Hogg why the footage of the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus wasn't made into a movie until now.
When we shot it, the Rolling Stones, as the hosts of the event, had, with all the other people, shown up at noon to do the entrance of the circus players. And then, as the hosts, they let all the other musicians, all the other bands, go on before them. And so the Rolling Stones didn't get on stage till 2 in the morning. And they'd been hanging around for 14 hours. And the Rolling Stones session went on till 7 in the morning. So they went on for 5 hours to record the 5 or 6 songs we use in the picture. When we put a rough cut together, the Stones felt that they were not as fresh as, for example, The Who had been. And we shot The Who's sequences at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So the Stones, on their own show, didn't want anyone to be, in their view, sort of better than they were because of being fresher. So we were going to reshoot the Rolling Stones sequence. But the set of the circus, it was a set, it was done in a studio, was torn down. And then a year went by before we tried to reshoot it. We didn't have time. The Stones went on tour. Jagger did a movie. A year then suddenly had gone by. And it had missed its moment. Rock and roll projects in those days, if they lost their kind of momentum, sort of got shelved for a while.
Do you think that Mick Jagger's appraisal of their performance was accurate? Did you agree that they weren't in top form?
Yeah, I think in one way it was accurate because they were sort of... with the Rolling Stones and with the Beatles, who I worked with a few months later in Let It Be, is we all think of them in a funny way as performers, as sort of public figures that we own and see on stage. But in fact, they're musicians first. And I think musically, they maybe weren't as strong as they could have been. But the Rolling Stones, at their total best or at 98% best, are still a phenomenal, unforgettable rock and roll act. And when anyone who sees the Stones' performance in the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus... will be completely knocked out by them. I mean, they and the Who, and with John Lennon, you can't say who's better. They all are sensational.
Well, let's get back to the story about why this film wasn't made 28 years ago, but why it was made now. Why can you make it now?
Because we found it. What happened was the end of the story is that the Rolling Stones in the early 1970s left England for tax reasons and went to live in France. The film, since we didn't have a cutting room anymore, the film had been stored in their offices. When they went to France, they didn't need the big offices they had in London, so they had smaller offices. And all the film footage, cans of film, rough cut, negative, was moved to that office. There was no room in the second office for all the cans of film. So a man called Ian Stewart, who was very, sort of is called the Rolling Stones road manager, but he's much, much more than that, to protect these cans of film, he thought someone one day might want them, took them out of London and put them in his barn in his house in England, where they remained for, I think, 15 years. So, and not everybody knew where the cans of film were, because Stu told us, but I think people forgot. Then he died, and his family was looking through his effects, and they went out to the barn, and they found these cans of film, you know, with hay on top of them, and with the lawnmower parked in front of them and stuff like that. And then his wife, Cynthia, called, I guess, the Stones office and said, you know, we've got this film here, the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. And so after 15 years of being lost, as far as we all knew, we started to reassemble the material, which took quite a lot of detective work because it wasn't all there. And that's why we're able to release the picture 28 years later, because we found it, found lost footage, found color footage where there was black and white originally, and edited the picture to what the audience will see now.
I want you to talk a little bit about filming the performances, what kind of angles you wanted for the cameras. For example, when Jagger is singing "You Can't Always Get What You Want," mm-hmm. it looks as if he's singing directly into the camera.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is. We talked about him playing to the audience in the circus under the small big top. And we'd also talk to him playing to the audience at home. And we thought, well, if some of it doesn't work, we can always cut to the other angles. What I'd learned from Ready, Steady, Go, the rock and roll show I used to do on TV, is that it's good if the rock and rollers, if the performers are up a little bit, if they're on a stage so that some of the angles are low, the angles are a little bit more dramatic. But you don't only want low angles, you want to have angles which can be shooting down and stuff like that. But it's just really, I shot it pretty much the way I'd been doing Ready, Steady, Go for a year and a half, you know, before the circus.
Do you have a favorite performance in the Rock and Roll Circus?
I love The Who. I love John Lennon. But the great performance for me is Mick Jagger doing Sympathy for the Devil at, what the audience doesn't know, what I know is like 6 o'clock in the morning. And he performs the song as a kind of act of will, so he's not going to be tired anymore, so he can galvanize his band, so he can thrill the audience. He does it out of willpower as much as his talent, and it's an extraordinary performance.
In Sympathy for the Devil, Mick Jagger takes off his shirt, shows his tattoos, and finishes the song. Did you know in advance he was going to do that, or was that spontaneous?
I knew he had the tattoos. I didn't know what he was going to do with them.
Are those permanent tattoos or just things for the performance?
Just for the performance, I'm glad to say. The Stones shot their sequence between 2 and 7 in the morning, and they were really tired by the time we came to do Sympathy for the Devil. So tired, in fact, that we stopped shooting for a while and had a meeting about would we come back the next evening and all go home to bed for a while. And Mick said, no, I can do one more if you can do one more and if the sound people can do one more. That is to say, I'll give you everything I got so long as the cameramen will do it and the engineers will do it too. So without a lot of confidence that this would work, we went back to shoot again. And Mick's performance in Sympathy for the Devil with his tattoos is improvised, and I think it is probably as good a performance I've seen in any theatrical form as long as I've been going to the theater, seeing rock and roll, seeing movies, which he came up with at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm May, well, it takes. I've been around
That's from the CD, The Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, a companion to the new documentary film that was actually shot 28 years ago in performance at a television studio in England. And my guest is the director of that film, Michael Lindsay Hogg. You know, shortly after this performance, I guess about a year later, was Altamont, in which the Rolling Stones sang Sympathy for the Devil while a Hell's Angel stabbed somebody to death in the audience. And I wonder, after having shot this performance of Sympathy for the Devil, what you thought about hearing about Altamont and later watching the footage of the performance?
Oh, gee, you know, they just got in the wrong place at the wrong time. They'd done a concert in England earlier in the year, which had been monitored by the Hell's Angels, who were the sort of doing crowd control. And everything went fine. The Hell's Angels were friendly, you know, looked threatening, but didn't do anything to anybody. And I think, you know, when the Stones came to Altamont, which was a free concert, which was a concert which they, because they'd canceled the concert, I think that they wanted to give a free concert. And I don't think they ever had any idea how crazy and out of hand everything got there, because they were in the middle of a field. You couldn't get in, you couldn't get out. There was no police. It was just it was anarchy, I think. And they got trapped in that. You know, the last thing any of them would have wanted would be for someone to get killed in the middle of a performance.
Were you shocked when you heard about it?
Well, shocked and saddened, sure. But you know, rock and roll. A lot of rock and roll has had a funny history of tragedy. It's part of the kind of shadow side of rock and roll. If you think about the guy who's killed at Altamont, people trying to get into a Who concert in Cincinnati, and all the early deaths of a lot of the greatest rock and roll musicians. If you think of Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Brian Jones, et cetera, I mean, it's always had another side to it, which a side of accident and tragedy.
John Lennon is one of the guests on the Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Circus that was shot in 1968, and he plays there with a different configuration of musicians. It's not the Beatles. It's Eric Clapton, someone from the Jimi Hendrix experience. Mm-hmm. Was that like a reprieve for him to be away from the Beatles? Did he particularly enjoy that opportunity?
I think so. He came in at the last minute. Originally, it was going to be Steve Winwood, who was going to front a pickup band, and then Stevie got sick and got a cold, and then Mick called up John, and John had wanted to play with or had been playing with Eric, and so they came sort of as buddies, and then Keith Richards played bass, and as you say, Mitch Mitchell from Jimi Hendrix played drums. Yeah, I think it probably was. John, you know, not long after, did go and play, I think, in Canada with Eric Clapton and a band of new musicians. There was a certain feeling at the time that everybody kind of wanted to play with other people, too, and not only be locked into those four or five others, but also experiment and move around a little bit. But, of course, like, in one way, the Beatles, the Stones, and others, they've been playing with each other since they were teenagers, and so there was a certain amount of safety and comfort in that for some people, and then for other people, they wanted to break away.
There's a scene in the Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Circus in which Mick Jagger, who's in the role of ringmaster, introduces John Lennon. And they're kind of bantering back and forth, and it's very historically interesting. On the other hand, I don't think it quite works. What is this part about?
In England, people used to like to pretend to have American accents and be like announcers on radio or TV shows, which I think what Mick is doing. And the reason we kept it in the picture is really just Mick and John talking and about to introduce John's band that he's about to play with. John had a very quirky, punning, satirical kind of sense of humor, which sometimes hit the target, sometimes just missed a little bit. But we kept it in the film because there you have the two real representatives of the generation sitting together and talking, Mick Jagger and John Lennon.
Actually, let's hear this from the CD version of the Rolling Stone Rock and Roll Circus.
Winston, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's really nice to have you, John. As you know, I've admired your work for so long and haven't been able to get together with you so much as I want.
It's not been my fault, Michael.
Do you remember that old place off Broadway?
Those were the days I want to hold you, man. Remember that.
John, I want to talk to you about your new group, the Dirty Mac,
sure.
which you got together for tonight's show.
Well,
comprises of yourself and...
Myself, that's Winston Legthigh, you know. And we've got Mitch Mitchell from the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Oh, you really?
Yeah,
experienced.
Really. Oh, very, very. You've read my file. And we've got Eric Clapton from the Cream, the late great Cream. Michael, the
Fantastic.
Late great. And we've got Keith Richard, your own soul brother.
Dirty.
Great.
This is John Lennon and Mick Jagger from the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. We'll talk more with the film's director after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Lindsay Hogg, director of the film The Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. Although the film was just released, the concert it documents was held in 1968. You got your start filming music in the British TV series Ready, Steady, Go, which I think Americans aren't really familiar with. Why don't you describe what the series was like?
Ready, Steady, Go was a live, live on the air television show, which went on every Friday night, in originating out of London across the country, and it was the right show at the right place and the right time. It at that time in England, all the great English bands were just bursting: the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, the Who, the Kinks, the Yardbirds, the Animals, etc., etc. And Ready, Steady, Go had these musicians on regularly. The discovered the Who, pretty much. The Stones were close to being the house band. I mean, they'd come on even if they weren't plugging a record. We also were the first show to have live sound, because in those days, other shows had the musicians lip-syncing. And we, in a very primitive way to start with, and then more sophisticatedly, had live sound so the musicians could come on and play anything they wanted, not only the show they were plugging. Also, we lit it in a very sort of more movie-like way, more faces against dark backgrounds, and we had a lot of good camera work. So it was a very exciting show to watch, with the added ingredient of being live. So if something got screwed up, it got screwed up. And if there was something magical, there it was and gone forever. Because in those days, they often didn't make protection videotape copies. Just, you know, you'd have the show and it would go out and that was it.
I wonder what the British invasion looked like to you from a British perspective.
Well, I'm American, and so I was over there, kind of as in a dual role, as working in England, but I was American. It was an astounding time, like 1964 or 1965, because it wasn't just one good band; it was 10 of them, and they all were friendly, and which is part of the reason why the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus got set up. I mean, you could go into there was a nightclub in London called the Ad Lib, and the good place to sit was on the right-hand side as you came in the banquettes. And you would find two Rolling Stones, three Beatles, an Animal, a Yardbird, Bob Dylan, the Kinks, all just around sitting together talking. And so it was a very close-knit group, the British Explosion. It was a very close-knit group, everybody mainly working and for the most part living in London. Everybody knew everybody, so it was close, friendly, and also rivalrous, because everybody wanted to be top. But it was an extraordinary time with just an immensely talented group of people.
Now, how much power did you have to make or break acts by booking or not booking them on Ready, Steady, Go?
Oh, quite a lot, but our aim was not to make or break. Our aim was to give exposure to people we thought were good. Pretty much, you know, if we positioned a song right in the show and did it right, and if it was like number two or three in the charts, it would usually be number one the next week. I mean, so we had a lot of influence, but we saw our influences as mainly being to highlight bands which the audience wanted to see and to discover bands which they didn't know about yet.
Is there any band that you're proud to say you kept off the show?
No, not proud to kept off, but sometimes we inherited bands from other shows. Like there was a show in England which went off the air, which booked folk singers because we were in the same TV studio. We inherited one of the folk singers. And very much against our will, this kid came out with his guitar, and he wasn't rock and rolly, we didn't think. And so every rehearsal, we used to cut a verse of his song. In the dressing room before the show, I used to go and see everybody, and I went to see this kid, and his head was in his hands. And I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "You don't understand. My song is a story, and you can't just keep cutting chapters of my story." I said, "I'm sorry, but this is what it has to be." So he went on and played his song, which was called "I Am a Rock," and it was Paul Simon. And this was in his days as a kind of folky in London, and before he hit it with Simon and Garfunkel. So we got this kid, we didn't want him, and then the rest is history. That was a mistake I think we made.
Well, he forgave you. You did his Graceland video.
He did forgive me, thank God, yeah. He's turned into one of the prime musicians of our century.
What's it like for you now to have a movie that like sold out the moment the tickets became available at the New York Film Festival 28 years after you shot it?
Oh, listen, it's nice. I mean, there's a whole generation of people who've been born since the movie was made and who'll get a chance to see really some of the greatest rock and roll performers of all time performing at the absolute peak of their powers. And also being able to feel a kind of sense of poignancy because some of them died before their time. And so it's a very rich and satisfying film, as well as being great rock and roll.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Lindsay Hogg directed the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus. The concert has just been released on home video and CD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's more of the Rolling Stones performance from the film.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, restoring Alfred Hitchcock's masterpiece, Vertigo. We'll meet Robert Harris and James Katz, who oversaw the restoration. They'll tell us how they did it and why they had to. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Claire Bloom's memoir, Leaving a Doll's House, about her marriage to Philip Roth. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Alfred Hitchcock's 1958 masterpiece, Vertigo, has just been restored in 70mm with Dolby sound. The movie stars James Stewart as a cop who develops vertigo after falling from a roof while chasing a suspect. While he recovers, he's hired by an old friend to do some detective work. The friend says his wife thinks she's possessed by a spirit, and he fears she'll kill herself. Stewart is mesmerized by this haunted beauty, played by Kim Novak. She sees frightening visions.
There's a room, and I sit there alone, always alone.
What else?
Grave.
Where?
I don't know. It's an open grave, and I stand by the gravestone looking down into it. It's my grave.
But how do you know?
I know.
But is there a name on the gravestone?
No. No, it's new and clean and waiting.
Well, what else?
It's part of his dream, I think. There's a tower and a bell in the garden below. It seems to be in Spain. Village in Spain. It clicks off and it's gone.
Portrait. Do you see a portrait?
No.
If I could just find the key, the beginning, and put it together.
So explain it away. There is a way to explain it, you see. If I'm mad, then that would explain it, wouldn't it?
Madeline!
Vertigo is restored by my guests Robert Harris and James Katz, who also restored Spartacus, Lawrence of Arabia, and My Fair Lady. Katz was president of Universal Pictures' Classics Division in the early 80s when they re-released five Hitchcock films, including Vertigo. That's when he realized what bad shape Vertigo was in. I asked him why he and Harris decided to restore it.
It's one of the most important American films ever made. It's considered one of Hitchcock's masterpieces. And it was a large format film, which is something that Bob and I specialize in. And we thought there was an audience out there again for this, because a whole generation plus has passed and without seeing these films on the big screen.
So what was the state of Vertigo when you decided to restore it?
Well, when we opened the cans, we found that the camera negative was very faded, extremely faded in some areas, very faded in others. The black and white separations, which protect the negative, were shrunken, and they weren't made terribly well. And the sound elements were basically gone. They had all been junked in 1967, and everything in sound went back to a 1958 optical print. The only interesting thing that we did find were the original Bernard Herrmann floor recordings, which had been sitting in a vault at Paramount for 38 years.
So the floor recordings are what, the original?
The original recordings, which were done in three-track stereo.
Wow, well, that must have been exciting to find.
That was a very exciting find for us.
In fact, there's a new star of this version of Vertigo, and that's the Bernard Herrmann score, because we've been able to feature it to a far greater degree than it's been in the past.
You mean you mixed it in differently than it had been in the past?
It's a totally new mix. We had to. In order to use the music, we had to derive what would be a dialogue stem from this 1958 optical unit, which was not terribly great quality. The dialogue elements were digitized, removed, and when you do that, you lose all of your Foley, which are body sounds, touching cloth, movement, things like that.
Footsteps, car door
right,
slamming.
Car door slamming. Those are sound effects. Foley is basically the body sounds.
Right. Okay.
So we lost the Foley, lost the effects, and then had to go back and create all new stereo Foley, all new stereo effects, and mix those in with the stereo music and the clean dialogue.
You'll hear this and see this film in a way that Hitchcock never saw it or heard it.
Well, gee, I'm not sure if I have mixed feelings about that or not. You know, when I see a restoration, I suppose part of me wants to be convinced this is exactly how it looked when it was first made. This is exactly what Hitchcock wanted.
Well, he actually, we also have Madonna doing a song over the main title track. Which
see, you're really selling out.
Now, this is a big, there's an ethical question here, and it's something that we're confronted with on a regular basis. You know, when we were doing Spartacus, we had Stanley Kubrick to speak to and Kirk Douglas, who was the producer. On My Fair Lady, we had to make judgments all the time, and on Vertigo, every day was a decision. Once we knew that we wanted to use the original sound recordings, we knew there would be fallout. We knew that we would be doing a new Foley and effects track, but we used the original track from another print as a map, and we followed each sound and each effect very, very carefully.
We also had all of Hitchcock's dubbing notes, which survive. We do a great deal of research. We'll do research for 3 or 4 or 5 months sometimes to get every piece of paper, anything that we could possibly find that can be useful. And on this picture, very fortunately, we had all of the daily continuity reports, all of the camera reports, and lastly, and possibly most importantly for the track, Hitchcock's original dubbing notes with all of his thoughts on them, on how every sound effect should be handled.
Tell us something interesting from those dubbing notes that helped guide you.
Well, one thing we had was we knew that Hitchcock's philosophy was pretty much less is more. And whenever there was a temptation to do something or add something, we really thought carefully about it. And the interesting thing was that in 1957-58, they would have to conceptualize the reel before they were able to actually make a pass at it in the dubbing theater. They didn't have what we call rock and roll, where you can go back and forth now and correct even a scene, a line.
A frame.
A frame of film can be corrected now. So they would conceptualize the reel and give not only the specifics, but they would try and describe the effect that they wanted that reel to have in relation to the picture as a whole. And all of these notes were very specific in that to that extent. And we also had Hitchcock's producer, who was called associate producer, Herbert Coleman, who's now 89 years old and lives in Salinas, California. And we would call him and ask him about the various nuances, and he was very much involved in that, and it was a tremendous help to us, as were many people from the original production.
Yeah, we really did have a brain trust of production personnel.
How would Hitchcock describe in his dubbing notes the effect that he wanted the music to have?
For example, there's a sequence in the film where Jimmy is following Kim around San Francisco, and at one point she enters the McKittrick Hotel, and you see her go upstairs. You don't see her go upstairs, but you see her open a window upstairs. Jimmy follows her in and looks up to a very ornate wooden ceiling and hears off-screen, yes, and the yes is coming from Ellen Corby, who's the, as she's called, the manageress of the hotel, and it causes him to look down to see her. And you then cut to the desk, and in 35-millimeter prints, you couldn't see it, but in 70, you can see her lips moving, doing a silent yes. So this was actually originally production dialogue. Hitchcock moved it up so that it was off-screen, and it is the cause of Jimmy Stewart looking down. Now, the fellows on the boards did it two ways for us. They synced the yes up and made it production dialogue again, and then said, well, we can actually make this better in quotes, by using a paper shuffle or a drawer slam or something that will, an effect that will cause him to look down, and then we'll have the dialogue in the place that it would have been. But the decision was made very simply to not do that, because Hitchcock made this decision in 1958, and we don't have the right, we don't have the moral right to change things of that sort. We have an obligation to keep things as pure as possible. Another interesting point is that when you work on a picture that's 38 or 40 or 45 years old, whatever these pictures happen to be, you're dealing with an old optical soundtrack. And these tracks have hisses and pops and dead space in them, which you could not hear through the reproduction equipment of the 1950s. Today, they stand out like a sore thumb. They really become horrific on modern equipment. So we have to add nuances like room tone or a very, very subtle effect to fill things in and to give it a little body, because to play back an optical copy of a 1958 track really does an injustice to the film.
Every defect becomes magnified.
Oh,
every stray sound.
It's extremely magnified. There's one couple of things in My Fair Lady. You can actually hear a fly buzzing around the set, moving from left to right in one scene. As Rex Harrison sits down in one of his overstuffed chairs, he was body mic'd. You can hear as the cushions give way. We had major problems with him because he was live mic'd. All of his songs were recorded live. They were extremely strident. It was the first time that a radio microphone was used, and they had constant problems. They were picking up the local police departments as he was singing occasionally.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Robert Harris and Jim Katz, and they've just restored the Alfred Hitchcock classic Vertigo. We'll talk more about the restoration after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Harris and Jim Katz. They just restored Vertigo. They also, earlier, restored Lawrence of Arabia, Spartacus, and My Fair Lady. You consulted with a lot of the people who are still alive, who participated in the making of Vertigo. Tell me one of the more interesting stories that you were told that helped inform you in your restoration of the movie.
Well, one thing that we knew for a fact but was constantly reiterated by Herbert Coleman was that Hitchcock just didn't like to shoot on location. And there was an inordinate amount of rear screen projection in this film, and they were on a corner in San Francisco, which was by Scotty's apartment, and they had a crew out there some ungodly hour. And they were ready to shoot, and Hitchcock pulls up, which was his wont, in his limousine, and lowered the window about a quarter of the way and said to Herbie, "Why did you pick the windiest corner in San Francisco to do this? Let's do this in the studio." And most of the shots around Scotty's apartment were done with rear screen projection in the studio. But all you have to do is look at the picture and see how it works and how what a genius he was, and how every shot was he would draw shots. We have illustrations of him, of his, that would show exactly where he wanted the camera, how what the moves would be, in his own hand.
Alfred Hitchcock very carefully chose the palette for Vertigo. What did you have to do to find out what the real true colors were, since what you were looking at wasn't true colors at all? You were looking at faded, messed up.
Well, there are two things. Number one, there were Technicolor prints, which one would think would be a reference, but since they're made with different types of dyes, and they don't fade, they gave us a reasonable reference. But for example, one of the dresses that Kim wears in a scene comes out as sort of a cyanish green, and we would basically do everything that we could to find examples. Jim spent a lot of time looking for a color chip, which I think we can let him tell you about.
Madeline, the character Kim Novak plays, drove a green Jaguar, or as I found out in my studies, Jaguar. And we tried to get the company in Coventry, England, to send us the paint chips from that year. So at least we had a basis for the color reference on the car, and the costume that we had of Kim's was the green costume as Judy, where she's in the hotel room toward the end of the film. The costume has a polka dot collar, and that was faded as well. But at least it gave us a ballpark. It gave us some idea of what we were looking for in these colors that were not heavy primary colors. And there are any number of instances throughout the film where we would try to at least get some idea. We found one of the discarded portraits of Carlotta, and that gave us a bit of a hint into what the bouquet looked like.
Now, here's what you got to tell me about. I read that you found an alternate ending to the film. I think the studio asked Hitchcock to try it out this way. So I'm dying to hear about this.
It's an extended ending, really. It's not an alternate ending. Uh-huh. And this is something that we're really very anxious to emphasize. The ending was basically required to satisfy censorship in countries abroad and in the French Canadian provinces. And after the really dramatic ending of Jimmy Stewart looking down...
Wait, for people who haven't seen the movie, you turn out for a second, and then maybe the rest of us can hear what you have to say, because I really want to hear this without destroying it for anybody else. Go ahead.
Well, the ending, as we all know and love it, is a very dramatic shot of Jimmy Stewart standing on the precipice of... The tower at San Juan Batista. What happens is it fades out, and we fade into Midge's apartment, and Barbara Belgetti's, who plays Midge, is sitting by a radio, and she is listening to a reporter saying that Gavin Elster has been spotted in Paris, and they do not see any reason why they should not apprehend him shortly, or words to that effect. Jimmy Stewart comes into the apartment. She clicks off the radio when she hears him, gets up and mixes him a drink and walks over to the big window overlooking San Francisco, hands him the drink, and they look at each other, and we fade out. So basically we're telling the audience that the bad guy has been caught.
Right. Gavin Ulster's the guy who frames Jimmy Stewart.
Right. Right.
What would censors want with that ending? Why?
Well, there are just countries that require, find it necessary to make sure that the bad guy is caught and is punished, and they can't get away. And in the version that everybody knows, we never hear much more about Gavin Elster, and in this case, we know that everything's been resolved, but the bad guy's also been caught, so we've tied it all up into a neat package. But it takes so much away from the ending of the film, the drama of the end of the picture, that it was ridiculous that it was even shot. And you know that Hitchcock did it grudgingly, and
right.
even at this point, the family has asked us not to release this in any way, in which we're happy to honor.
Did Hitchcock write anything about that in his notes?
He said it wouldn't be shown
over his dead body.
Which is sort of, there's a macabre humor in that somewhere.
So we're trying not to show. We certainly don't want to run it theatrically.
Right, right. I'm sure you still have questions that you'd love to hear Hitchcock answer. What question would you most like to have been able to ask Hitchcock about Vertigo?
Why he did certain things in certain ways, the concept behind coming up with the area where the camera and Jimmy and Kim turn, which makes it appear that the set is changing. I'd love to know how he came up with some of those ideas. I mean, we're dealing really with one of the most brilliant filmmakers that ever lived. A great showman, but he had a sense of style and a sense of taste that I think in many ways were incomparable. And his technical prowess was extraordinary. And when you see some of these things, you often wonder, what is it? You know, how would he get these ideas?
Well, thanks for restoring movies I want to see.
You're welcome.
and thanks for being with us.
Our pleasure.
Robert Harris and James Katz restored the 1958 Alfred Hitchcock film Vertigo. The new Dolby soundtrack will soon be out on CD In the meantime, you can hear The Suite from Vertigo on a new Los Angeles Philharmonic album of Bernard Herrmann's film scores. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Claire Bloom's memoir about her marriage to Philip Roth. This is Fresh Air. Philip Roth is one of our most autobiographical novelists. In fact, throughout his career, he's been accused of being too self-absorbed and of treating his family and lovers rather harshly in print. In an ironic turning of the tables, however, Roth's ex-wife, British actress Claire Bloom, has written a memoir about their 18 years together in which she reveals disturbing details of Roth's behavior. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Bloom's book, Leaving a Doll's House, is an understandable attempt to get even, but in this case, writing well would have been the best revenge.
Forget the First Wives Club. If all the women who've served as helpmates to male writers over the centuries ever banded together, their cries for vengeance would rock the earth. Leading the pack would be Vivian Elliott, whose lifelong fragile mental condition was weakened when she discovered that her husband, T.S., had copied down her ravings and recycled them as lines in the wasteland. And then there's Zelda Fitzgerald. F. Scott allegedly lifted passages from her journals for his own novels. William Wordsworth and Henry James catapulted into the canon, while their ingenious sisters languished in obscurity. And Shakespeare's wife, Anne, was left only the second best bed in his will. No doubt about it, the lot of women in the orbit of literary great men has generally been a thankless one. That's why the news that talented actress Claire Bloom was writing a tell-all memoir about her years with Philip Roth has generated such anticipatory glee. Leaving a Doll's House promised to be one of those rare instances when a resentful muse would break her silence. And the projected target was not just any male writer, but the creator of such misogynist marvels as Sophie Portnoy. As expected, Bloom has plenty of dirt to dish. What she doesn't have, unfortunately, are elementary writing skills. Doubts as to Bloom's storytelling ability are stirred up in the first chapters, where she recalls her wartime childhood, her acting debut at age 14, and her romantic encounters with Richard Burton, Laurence Olivier, and Yul Brynner. Potentially engaging material, but Bloom has not grasped the first rule of creative writing: show, don't tell. She calls Burton her first and greatest love, yet when it comes to describing one of the most gifted and handsome wastrels of the 20th century, all Bloom can tell us is, Burton had a quality that was quite undefinable and that I have never seen in any other actor. She might as well be referring to Danny DeVito. Ironically, relief from these narrative doldrums arrives when Roth materializes on the scene. Roth is like Satan in Milton's Paradise Lost. We know we're not supposed to like him, but he's such an outrageously nasty contrast to the pallid Bloom that he's utterly compelling. In telling damning stories against him, Bloom makes the mistake of quoting Roth, and his wicked words slice through the overstuffed vagueness of Bloom's writing style. At one point, Roth is prevailed upon to buy a bed for Bloom's teenage daughter, and he sends the daughter a note that in part reads, "Here's the money for the whole bed, but if I ever hear that a goy is sleeping on the other half, I swear to you that I'll jump out of the window, and then you'll live with that for the rest of your life, and you'll see how much you enjoy the bed." When Roth eventually serves Bloom with divorce papers, he also bombards her with insane faxes that announce he's levying a fine of $62 billion, $1 billion for every year of Bloom's life, for her attempt to break the hardball prenuptial agreement she was originally obliged to sign. Almost certainly, Roth sounds like a horror. According to Bloom, he taped their phone conversations, cheated on her, and even propositioned her daughter's best friend. And of course, he committed the more mundane writerly crime of scavenging Bloom's mannerisms and personality for his novels, most notably Deception. But in his books, the depraved Roth did for Bloom what she can't do for herself in her own book. He made her interesting. Perhaps, instead of trying to write her memoir herself, Bloom should have taken a cue from the title of one of her ex-husband's best novels and hired the ghostwriter.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air was produced today by Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Tracy Tannenbaum, Barbara Bogave, and Lawrence Donahue Green. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the difference between being alone and being lonely. Essayist Vivian Gornick talks about living alone in the city. Also, a look back at the Prohibition era. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.